This is The Guardian.
Today, how to get a hostage deal between Israel and Hamas from a man who's made one before and knows what it takes. Israel is, at the moment, consumed by protests and discontent over the fate of more than 100 Israeli hostages in Gaza.
This country was built on some core values. One of them is strictly that the government of Israel will do everything in its power to bring back hostages and soldiers from captivity wherever they are.
For nearly a year now, there's been no deal to free them and to end a war that's killed more than 40,000 Palestinians, mostly civilians. Even between such vicious enemies, hostage deals are possible. The Israeli negotiator Gershon Baskin knows that because he's helped to put one together.
And that was my mission. That was my job. I would talk to the devil if that was necessary to bring them home.
For years, he was possibly the only Israeli in regular contact with a senior Hamas leader. They talked on the phone hundreds of times, met each other, had deep, serious conversations about how these two sides could, if not make peace, at least forge a kind of long-term truce. Last summer, they were planning another round of peace talks, and then Gershon's Hamas contact abruptly said he couldn't meet. And on October 7, Gershon and the world learned why. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, The Negotiator, the story of the Israeli who still talks to Hamas. Gershon, where does your story start?
I guess my story begins when I was a child. I grew up in the United States in a suburb of New York City. As a youngster, at the tail end of the 1960s, and found myself getting, at the age of 12, involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement, dragging my parents to drive me to demonstrations and the civil rights movement. And my local congressman, a man named Allard Lowenstein, was the person who led in the U.S. Congress the fight against the war in Vietnam. And I met him as a 12-year-old. I went door-to-door with him campaigning on weekends, and that was very inspiring. I grew up in a very Jewish neighborhood of Long Island. At the age of 14, my family moved to a place further east on Long Island to a neighborhood that was very un-Jewish. And my first week in school, in my new school, a Jewish classmate approached me and said, "We're starting a chapter of a Zionist youth movement in our town called Young Judea." I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what a Zionist youth movement was. I knew it might be a place to meet Jewish girls, so I joined. I thought it was interesting. It was intellectually challenging. It was interesting to deal with questions of identity that we were faced with. Who are we and where we belong? And somewhere along the line in the early 1970s, my general political outlook of the world merged with my understanding that Israel was going to be my home.
So you feel this pull towards Israel, and in fact, you move there for a year after high school, but you also become very aware of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. What was your involvement in that, in those early years?
From 1975, I wrote my first op-ed piece in a Jewish newspaper out of Berkeley, California, in which I said that if Israel wants to be the democratic nation state of the Jewish people, it can't rule over another people. It needs to be free from its occupation. It needs to allow the Palestinian people to rule themselves and live in peace side by side with Israel. And when I wrote that article, I was attacked pretty brutally by a lot of Israeli friends or people who called themselves friends. And they called me a naive, stupid American. And they said I didn't understand what I was talking about. And the thing that got to me more than anything else is they kept saying, "You don't know them." Them, of course, being the Arabs. I wasn't wise enough or knowledgeable enough at that time to ask the question, "Well, how do you know them?" If I did, I would have found out that they don't. They have no idea. But what I did understand that if I wanted to be political and be involved politically once I did move to Israel, which happened in 1978 at the age of 22, I would have to gain credibility.
So you gained that credibility by initially going to live inside Palestinian villages in Israel, becoming actually the first Israeli civil servant responsible for Jewish-Arab relations inside the country. You've said what you really wanted to work on was the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. So what was your first real on-the-ground experience with that?
In the end of 1987, the first Intifada broke out.
Again today, all over the West Bank and Gaza Strip, young Palestinians rioted against Israeli occupation.
It's been going on every day for 7 days, and there's no sign that it's going away.
And in March of 1988, in the fourth month of the Intifada, I got on my little Vespa motorcycle and rode to the Dehesha refugee camp, which is south of Jerusalem, south of Bethlehem, the largest refugee camp in the West Bank. And I entered the refugee camp. There's a United Nations school there. And I took off my helmet and I was immediately approached by young people who said, "Who are you? What are you doing?" And I explained to them that I'm an Israeli and I came to listen. I want to know what this Intifada is, what you're fighting about. Someone invited me to go into their home. I spent 6 hours in Dehesha that day, listening to people telling me what it is that they want, what it is they're fighting for. And I understood at that moment in March of 1988 that a revolution was taking place within Palestine, that people were coming to terms with Israel, were willing to accept an agreement on which they would get part of Palestine as an independent state. And I understood at that moment that the moment I was waiting for had come. And over the next month, I created IPCRI, the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, a joint Israeli-Palestinian public policy think tank and do tank, jointly run by Israelis and Palestinians, that proposed two really different radical ideas at that time. One was that we were going to create a joint institution run together on equality and parity by Israelis and Palestinians. And two, that our starting point from the work was agreeing to the two-state solution. And since 2000, the year 2000, we've been struggling on an uphill battle to try and rebuild the idea that peace is possible.
So you're essentially working as a peace activist, trying to build bridges between these two sides. And that eventually brings you into contact with a growing force in Palestinian politics. That's the militant group Hamas. Tell me about your first contact with them.
In 2005, by chance, I met someone from Hamas who came to a World Bank conference that I was at in Cairo. I was the only Israeli at this conference. This man was a professor of economics at the Islamic University in Gaza. And he came to Cairo because he heard there might be Israelis at this conference. He never met an Israeli before. In 20 years that I was working with Palestinians, I had never sat down and talked with anyone from Hamas. So it was a unique opportunity for both of us. We spent about 6 hours over the next 2 days talking. And at the end of the conference, I proposed to him that we could try to create some kind of ongoing dialogue group. And then in the end of June, a military operation took place through a tunnel that crossed into an Israeli military base in the south of the Gaza Strip in Kerem Shalom. They killed two Israeli soldiers and they wounded another and took him captive into Gaza. Gilad Shalit was his name. It took more than an hour before the army knew that he was missing. And a week later, this professor calls me and says, "Gershon, we have to do something. We're being bombed. We have no water. We have no electricity. This is really bad and it's going to get worse." And I said to him, "What can we do?" He said, "Let's try to open up a channel of communication." He went to the Hamas prime minister's office. They called me an hour later. And that's where my journey of 18 years of negotiating with Hamas began.
The person you were eventually put in touch with in the Hamas prime minister's office was a spokesman called Ghazi Hamad, who becomes this really key figure in your work over the next few decades, your partner in some ways. What do you remember about that first conversation with Ghazi?
Yeah, it was very striking because I remember I was in the kitchen. They actually called me on the house phone, a landline phone, which we don't really use much these days. But I'm standing there in the kitchen. I'm looking at my two sons. One of them is 15. The other is 17 at the time or something like that. And Ghazi Hamad starts speaking to me in Hebrew. And I say to him, "Ghazi, you can speak to me in English or Arabic if you want." And he says to me, No, I like speaking in Hebrew. It turned out I learned later that he spent 7 years in Israeli prison, and that's where he learned Hebrew. He didn't have many opportunities to speak Hebrew, and he spoke Hebrew. So that was really a kind of taking aback and, wow, this is weird. And the second thing was he asked to arrange a conversation with the father of the soldier who they abducted. So I'm looking at my two boys who are before draft age, thinking about this Hamas guy who wants to talk to the father of the soldier who they abducted. And it seemed to me to be one of these human moments. It took me several hours to track down the Shalit family. I didn't know them. I didn't know how to contact them. I got their phone number. They weren't at home. I left messages. Later in the day, a phone call took place between Noam Shalit, the father of Gilad Shalit, and Razi Hamad. The next day, Noam and Aviva Shalit, the mother, came to Jerusalem, and I met them for the first time. And I told them who I am and what I do. And I told them that I would be with them till the very day that Gilad Shalit comes home, that I would not abandon them.
Gilad Shalit read a prepared statement in Hebrew while holding a Palestinian newspaper. He sends his love to his family and says he hopes his government will soon win his release.
And Gershon, you were well placed to help with this process, not just because of your work as an activist, but because of something that had actually happened to your family not long before. Tell me about that.
6 months before, one of my wife's first cousins was abducted and murdered by Hamas. And when he disappeared, the family asked me to help to try and find him, and I tried and didn't succeed. They made a video of him handcuffed and blindfolded. He's an Iraqi Jew and he spoke Arabic. And he said out in Arabic that if Israel releases Palestinian prisoners, his life would be saved. I guess they knew that the Israeli security were on their tails, and they ended up murdering him with a butcher's knife and throwing his body on the side of a road. And at his funeral, standing over his grave, I swore to myself that if ever again something happened where I could save a human life, I would do everything humanly possible to do it. And that's how I found myself deeply engaged in the Shalit story. And Gilad Shalit was in captivity for 5 years and 4 months. And he was with me every single moment during those 5 years and 4 months.
So what was it like for you to suddenly be on the inside of this process of hostage negotiations between these two bitter enemies? What do you remember finding striking or unusual about the way these negotiations actually played out?
Well, it was very clear that there was a refusal of each side to talk with each other directly. I found myself in a very bizarre position that for some reason they were willing to talk to me in Hamas because I was not an official. And then I had this problem of how do I communicate with the Israeli officials. So the prime minister was Ehud Olmert at the time. And Olmert knew me, I knew him. We were not on the same page politically, and I knew there was no way I could get to him directly. So I decided to call his daughter, who was a well-known leftist who had participated in demonstrations against the Israeli government. And I called her and I asked her if she would be willing to deliver messages directly to her father. And she immediately agreed. She cautioned me that he probably wouldn't listen, but I had an open channel directly to the prime minister and directly to Hamas. What I needed to do was to convince the Israelis that I was talking to a channel that led directly to the people who were holding Gilad Shalit. Then it would be verified that this is a real channel and there was a reason to deal with me and to try and release Shalit. So the first thing I did was to propose to Hamas that they provide me with proof that he was alive. They said they would give me a videotape, but they wanted Israel to release 350 women and teenage prisoners in Israel, Palestinians. And I transmitted this message to Olmert, whose response was, we don't negotiate with terrorists. We don't pay for information. We know he's alive. So I went down to Gaza. I could still go to Gaza in those days. And I met with Razi Hamad in the prime minister's office. And I said to him, listen, the idea of the videotape is not going to go. Let's scrap the idea. Instead, give me a handwritten letter from Gilad Shalit in exchange for nothing. And he said, why would we do that? And I said, because it will open up the negotiations. And he liked the idea. He came back after 3 hours saying the message was delivered and he received a positive response. It took about another 3 weeks before that letter was delivered. And there was. There was proof of channel and proof of life. And A few days later, the Egyptians stepped in and demanded that they would take over the negotiations, and I was asked to stand down. I stood down, but one of the Egyptian intelligence officers told me to stay involved, which I did. It took another 5 years before the sides were ready to make an agreement, but Gilad Shalit is alive today because of my intervention in this whole story.
Just before sunset, and Israel's long-lost son was home at last after 5 years, 4 months in captivity. Gilad Shalit's tiny village in Galilee turned out for a glimpse, throwing flowers, garlanding him with a sea of flags. The 25-year-old waved briefly before disappearing with his family.
Did you ever think you will live to see the day when you can actually walk free?
They were long years. I believe the day would come, but it might not be for more long years. I hope this deal will help us reach peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
So this deal that you helped put together has been scrutinized quite a bit in the past year because it involved swapping this Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, for more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, including a man called Yahya Sinwar, who was then a Hamas official, but who would go on to become the leader of Hamas in the Gaza Strip and one of the masterminds of the October 7 attacks. I just wonder, how do you make sense of that deal now?
You know, I never dealt with the names, and I never thought that this was a good deal. No one asked me, by the way, but I never thought it was a good deal. But what I always said was it was the only deal that was possible to bring Gilad Shalit home. And I think that the whole world was in awe of Israel that it was willing to pay such a heavy price to bring one soldier home. How many other countries would do that? And I think it was something that pointed to the uniqueness of Israeli society, which unfortunately is lost today. It's not here anymore. He could have been sacrificed. Soldiers go to war and they get killed. The problem was that we knew that Gilad Shalit was alive. And Israel decided 80% of Israelis supported the deal. A bad deal. 26 members of the Israeli government voted for it. 3 opposed it. Netanyahu himself voted for it and told the government to vote for it.
As a soldier and an army officer, I was sent by the IDF to carry out dangerous missions. But I always knew that if I or any of my friends fell into enemy hands, the state of Israel would do everything in its power to bring us home.
In the course of this process of negotiating this deal, the 5 years that it took, you were one of the only bridges between these two sides, Hamas and Israel. How important was your relationship with your Hamas contact, Ghazi Hamad?
It was essential. I knew from the very beginning that if we were going to succeed, it's going to be based on the personal relationship that we develop. So I made sure over the years that we were talking, that we talked about family, we talked about dreams and hopes, we talked about our childhood, we talked about everything except the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the negotiations, along with the talk that we did about the negotiations, so that it was important that we develop a relationship. It was kind of funny because Ghazi is a deeply religious Muslim, and I'm an atheist. Ghazi used to joke with me all the time that he'll pray for me, because he knew that I didn't pray. That was the kind of relationship we developed. There were 3 times during the 5 years and 4 months that Gilad Shalit was in captivity that Ghazi Hamad and I negotiated ceasefires to get the Israelis and the Hamas to stop killing each other, shooting each other. On the day that Gilad Shalit was released and the first group of 450 prisoners were released by Israel, including 4 people who were responsible for killing my wife's cousin, Ghazi Hamad, early in the morning, like 7 o'clock in the morning, we spoke to each other and sort of congratulated each other. And he made a Freudian kind of slip, and he said, next time we'll negotiate peace. I think then he realized what he said, and he didn't really mean it. But that's what came out of his mouth, and it was quite telling after this a big achievement of negotiating this deal.
That dealing so closely with someone like Ghazi Hamad, who belongs to an organization that, in its doctrine, calls for the eradication of Israel, that is, as we know, a violent group that commits terrorist acts. I mean, was that ever challenging for you to try to forge a relationship with that man and with that organization?
It's a difficult question because I tried to avoid dealing with it. I was focused entirely on freeing Gilad Shalit. So I didn't stop to consider their political positions or their manifesto and their desire to kill everyone, including me. I hate to say this, but there is a sanctification of death within the culture of Hamas. It's not Palestinian culture. It's not Islamic culture. It's not what Islam is about. Islam is like other good religions that believes in the sanctity of life. But this is a distorted view of what Islam is. And that's what makes it so dangerous.
Did you remain in touch with Ghazi Hamad?
All the time. In the war that broke out in 2014, after Hamas operatives in the West Bank, without orders from Gaza or from the Hamas command, kidnapped three Israeli teenagers and executed them. Ghazi and I tried to prevent a large-scale war from breaking out. We realized that we were not going to be successful. That war broke out in 2014. At the end of the war, there were two bodies of Israeli soldiers who were taken by Hamas. And I immediately went into action with Ghazi trying to negotiate their release. And in 2022, I tried to convince Ghazi Hamad to go and meet with me, spend a few days together in Norway or Switzerland, where we could brainstorm together to figure out how to break out of this deadlock. He had agreed initially, then it never took place because the Norwegians sent someone to talk to him and he got cold feet. I learned later, by the time we were supposed to meet sometime in 2023, he was already in the know about a planned attack on Israel. And in July of 2023, I think he said to me, "I can't go." Which I didn't read anything into. Later, I understood it had to do with October 7th.
As warning sirens sounded across southern and central Israel, including in Jerusalem, Israel's military said it was on a war footing. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called an emergency meeting of security officials, and this morning's events are some of the most serious since Israel and Hamas fought a 10-day war in 2021.
What do you remember about October 7, 2023?
My wife and I had gone for a long holiday, the longest time we ever left Israel. We wanted to leave Israel during the Jewish holidays because it's kind of a crazy time here. And we were in Denmark, in Copenhagen, which is one of the most peaceful places in the world. And we woke up on the morning of October 7th, and my phone was ringing off the hook and WhatsApp messages, and I opened up and saw the computer and saw what was going on and devastated, just like everyone else. We had planned, we had tickets to return to Israel on October 10th, and I immediately got notification from Norwegian Air that the flight was canceled. By day two, I was already calling Ghazi Hamad. That night, the Israelis bombed his house. And I called him later that night to see if he was still alive and learned that he was. I asked about his family. He didn't answer me. The next morning, I started making phone calls to find out if a deal for releasing women, children, elderly, wounded, and sick hostages could be possible. I made some phone calls and found out that there was a relatively small number of women prisoners and teenage prisoners in Israel. None of them were important Hamas people. None of them were from Gaza. None of them had killed Israelis, and started sending messages to people in the Israeli war cabinet to find out if a deal could be made. I got positive answers from them, contacted Ghazi Hamad, started laying down the groundwork for a deal that would release the Israeli women and children, elderly, sick, and wounded. In the end, it was just women and children. There were 39 women prisoners and 190 teenagers, and I thought that a deal could be made for all of them in exchange for all the women, children, elderly, and sick and wounded. In the end, those negotiations were taken over at the official level, but I think I pretty much set the groundwork for that deal to be made. It was a no-brainer, because Hamas didn't really want to take all those people. They didn't have the logistics to deal with women and children and elderly hostages, and Israel could easily release these Palestinian prisoners.
Did you and Ghazi talk about what had happened? Talk about what Hamas had chosen to do on that day?
Not really. I mean, in the first days, I said to him, "Ghazi, if they bombed your house, then no one in Hamas has immunity, and you should know that they're going after everyone. And it's just a matter of time before they find you as well." 2 weeks later, I discovered that he wasn't even in Gaza. I was really taken back when I discovered that he wasn't in Gaza. He was in Beirut at the time. Ghazi Hamad is between us, he's a dead man walking. The Israelis are going to get him. The Israelis are going to get all the Hamas leadership, if not now, then later at some time. This is the way Israel works. Unfortunately, this is what Israel does. Every person who had anything to do with the abduction and the captivity of Gilad Shalit is no longer alive. Israel got every single one of them. And I'm quite sure that even if this war ends, and even if there is an eventual renewed peace process, a genuine peace process, the Israelis will go after everyone in Hamas who was responsible for October 7th. And Razi Hamad is in that category. He left Gaza. He will never return to Gaza again. He'll be living abroad the rest of his life. I think he knows that. And I don't think that any of these Hamas leaders, including Yahya Sinwar in Gaza, believe that they will have a long life.
I mean, Ghazi Hamad had left Gaza for Beirut. In fact, a few weeks after the attacks, he went on Lebanese TV to give an interview that has become infamous. It's been broadcast around the world because what he says is he isn't ashamed of what Hamas did that day. Quite the opposite. He says that Hamas is going to do it a second time, a third time, a fourth time, and that everything that they did was justified. This was a man you had been talking to for nearly two decades, somebody who called you a friend. What was it like for you to watch that interview?
It was pretty devastating. And I wrote a letter to him at that point in which I said, I never want to talk to him again. He lost his right to talk to me. The Razi Hamad that was interviewed on Lebanese television is not the Razi Hamad that I knew. I never called Razi a moderate. But he was the most practical person in Hamas that I ever met. He was the most pragmatic person. He had extreme ideas, but he actually, you know, talked about under what circumstances Hamas would be willing to at least have a Palestinian state next to Israel without having peace with Israel. We had those conversations, and Razi Hamad after that was a different person. I learned afterwards that 17 members of his close family were killed by Israel, and I'm sure that that impacted him. I cut off my contact with him, and that letter became viral. It was published around the world. Probably millions saw it. But a month later, a good Palestinian friend of mine said, you know, Gershon, you made a mistake, because maybe your contact with Razi Hamad could save lives. And I wrote to him again, and I said, Razi, if talking with you can save human lives, I'm willing to renew our connection. 3 weeks later, he contacted me. And since then, we've been in contact, not as regular as we were, but in the last 2 weeks, we have been proposing a deal to end this war, for Israel to withdraw from Gaza and for them to release all the Israeli hostages, 101 of them, in exchange for an agreed list of Palestinian prisoners, and to do this all in 3 weeks. And he assures me that the entire Hamas leadership agrees to this. Unfortunately, they won't announce it. I had a big argument with him over that. But he said if the Egyptians and the Qataris ask us, we will say yes, and we're going to push this forward and get this onto the agenda of the U.S. president, who said he's going to put down a new plan as a take it or leave it. This is my 24-7. I don't sleep at night thinking about this. It's what keeps me awake and keeps me moving all day long, trying to talk to every person in the world. This conflict needs to be resolved. And if it's not resolved, then this will just be another round in the more than 100 years in which Jews and Arabs have been killing each other over this land.
Coming up, what Gershon thinks is needed to make a hostage deal this time. Gershon, we learned over the weekend that six more Israeli hostages were executed by Hamas, apparently just before Israeli soldiers were able to reach them in a tunnel under Gaza. And that triggered some of the biggest protests in Israel since this war started, calling for a ceasefire and blaming Benjamin Netanyahu for failing to make that ceasefire happen. Do you think it's fair to blame him? And what do you think it would take for a breakthrough that ends this war and brings these hostages home?
Netanyahu is now responsible for murdering the six Israeli hostages, but he is responsible for them not coming home alive. He was refusing to end the war. And without ending the war, there is no agreement with Hamas. The only way we're going to get a ceasefire now is if his coalition breaks apart, which is very unlikely because they're all loyal to him and all afraid of losing their seats. We have very few politicians with integrity, particularly those in the coalition majority within the Israeli parliament, the Knesset. The taking to the streets is an act of desperation of the people of Israel. This is a very sad country. It's an angry country. It's a country in despair. And the majority of Israelis want a deal, but they're also afraid of a deal because they're afraid of Hamas. The tragic reality is that October 7th would have never happened if there had been 15 tanks on the ground and three helicopters in the air. It's not like Israel is facing the Russian army here. They're facing Hamas, and it could have been prevented, but Israel didn't defend its border on October 7th because the Israeli Defense Force had become the Israeli occupation police force in the West Bank, policing Palestinians and protecting Israeli settlers. October 7th happened because Benjamin Netanyahu, since 2009 and probably people before him in leadership in Israel, decided not to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This conflict was swept under the rug. It was ignored. It was evaded. They tried to manage it. They tried to imagine that we could reduce it, but refused to deal with it and to resolve it. And as long as the Palestinians don't have freedom and liberation and dignity, Israel will never have security. And October 7th is an act of desperation by people who have been caged in a territory like Gaza with horrid poverty and no hope for years. People in Gaza didn't support Hamas. They had no choice. Hamas ruled them brutally. And then Hamas committed atrocities that cross every moral human red line that's imaginable. But let's face it, Israel has crossed these moral red lines since October 7th in Gaza. And we have done things that should never be done and never be tolerated. So Netanyahu is responsible.
If Israeli leaders and Hamas can't end this war themselves, can't resolve this wider conflict, what will it take? Who can do that?
It seems that the only way it's going to happen is when there's significant international pressure. I commend the decision of the United Kingdom in realizing that there are licenses that are being issued on sending weapons to Israel that violate international law. We need pressure to come from the White House right now. Joe Biden is a free actor right now. There might be a possibility, not having to face elections, that he could actually do the right thing and put a plan on the table now, which is a good plan, that Hamas and Israel need to accept, and there would be significant pressure on Israel to do it. This war has to end. It has to end. Too many people have been killed. Too many innocent people have been killed. Too many lives have been destroyed. And there's disease in Gaza now, and hunger, and no clean water and sanitation, and 2 million homeless people. This has to be the last Israeli-Palestinian war. We can't keep doing this. We lack leadership in Israel and in Palestine. The new leaders of tomorrow have not yet stood up. They're out there, and they will. We will see them, because we cannot do this, and we need the world to stop allowing us to do this.
Gershon, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And that was Gershon Baskin. You can read more about the negotiations over a ceasefire in Gaza at theguardian.com, including a comment piece from Gershon titled, "These ceasefire talks have been doomed to fail. Netanyahu and Hamas have tied negotiators' hands." And that's it for today. This episode was produced by Eli Block and Charlie Duffield. Sound design was by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producer was Elizabeth Kasson. And we're back with you tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.